Computer says 6:01. So.
Okay. Welcome everyone to the Tescadero City Council meeting. And we did have a closed session that began at 5:30, and I will defer to the city attorney to give the report, please.
Thank you. We met in closed session on the case entitled Sousa Construction versus the City of Atascadero, and
I'm not sure if you're, are you on? I can't barely hear you.
My light is on. Okay. Am I not talking loud enough?
Get a little closer, maybe.
Yes, we had a closed session this evening on the case of Sousa Construction versus the City of Atascadero. And I'm reporting out that during the closed session, the council authorized the city attorney to defend the lawsuit. The substance of the litigation is it's a breach of contract case. And that's the end of the report.
Thank you. And we'll move to the Pledge of Allegiance, and I will lead that. So please all rise and follow me.
Ready to begin? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Marsha, can I have a roll call, please?
Yes. Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember?
To the council will be by Michael Manchek, President and CEO of the Economic Vitality Corporation. Welcome.
Much better? Good? Great. So I'm here to do two things. One, to commend the city on its economic development efforts. As an economic development organization, the EVC provides services and resources throughout the entire county, and we partner. We partner with cities, with chambers, and others. And we have been watching, as have other cities in the county, been watching what the City of Atascadero has been doing. And you should be very proud of what you're doing. You are doing everything by the playbook to help your local economy. The conferences that I go to elsewhere in other states, we watch what others are doing. We watch what's working. So I really commend you. The EVC also guarantees business loans and provides other services to your local businesses. And we're also hearing from them that you're doing a really excellent job. So thank you, and thank you for helping the county's economy. When one looks at the county's economy, segueing now, one looks at resources, one looks at infrastructure. Part of the infrastructure, which is a county-wide necessity, is the airport. And the EVC has been a sponsor by the City of Atascadero. So I'm here to not only thank you for the resources you've provided us to do this work, but give you just a snippet of the information that came from some of this work that has helped the airport in working hand-in-hand with airport management. So if I could go to next slide, please. So what caused some action? What caused recent action was last summer we lost approximately 40% of all air service at the airport, which meant that we lost about half of the airlines serving the airport. Delta stopped all service. American Airlines as well. American had been serving the airport for about 23 years. And then U.S. Airways canceled one flight. Next slide. And when looking at this problem, we realized that it was an impact and potentially a great impact to the county's economy. And again, if we're looking at the county's economy and all the cities in that, we realized that we had to pull together resources to help the airport. And two things we did immediately. Last summer, we commissioned one study, which was an analysis of air market service. So we knew where our airport lied. The consultants tells us that this means that there's a very strong interest on a local level for the airport. Next slide. So what did we do? We got together with the airport management, and in a minute I'll introduce Richard Howell. Richard is the airport manager. We got together with the airport and said, you know what, we've got to do something. We're going to do something that other communities elsewhere in the nation do, which is to create an advocacy group. So we created what's called San Luis Obispo County Air Transportation Alliance, in short, SLOCATA. And it's a volunteer organization managed by the EVC. Really, it's to help attract and retain air service at the airport. Next slide. So what did we accomplish since last summer? And let me preface this by saying that the airlines that we met with basically said they're not picking on Slo County. Right? These are systemic issues that were happening throughout the nation. And in fact, I'll be interested to hear what Richard says on this, but we fared pretty well compared to a lot of communities which never got back the service they lost. But it's a team effort. And with that, what we accomplished in meeting with U.S. Airways, we were able to get more service from them. With American, we didn't get service, but we learned a lot. We learned a lot about the market, what the airlines look for to sustain service. Then United, we're experimenting with some issues there that might help to get more service. But the two consulting firms we hired are listed on that slide. Next slide, please. So the airport traffic at to date, it's much like traffic elsewhere in the nation. The trend in the nation is from an economic development standpoint. So I'm not an expert on airports, but what we're seeing is this. We're seeing that there's fewer flights, the flights are more filled, and there's fewer low fares. So traveling by air isn't always a lot of fun these days, but it's a necessity for the local business community. And I know for a fact it is it's a necessity for some of the businesses in this city. It is not just for the tourism sector, for which it has a very, very large impact. But the load factors are very high. So the consultant's basically saying, not to repeat all this information on the slide, but the load factors are high. This airport is very, very competitive, which means that it's promising for us in looking to get more service here. Right? We're having to compete nationally. It is not this airport against other airports in the state. In fact, the airlines are saying they have very few planes, and they're going to be very selective as to where there's an airport fee waivers, for which Richard Howell was able to very successfully get the county to agree to. This is an incentivizing program to help the airlines come in and mitigate some of their risk. And then there's a federal grant for which has been commissioned, and we're waiting to hear on that. That's, again, an incentive program. Next slide. And so I'm almost at the end of this report. It was really more of a brief recap for the council and the city. But the Air Traveler Survey is the one that just closed out, and that's the one we really learned very much about. We're able to take this information. Again, thanks to you and the resources you've provided us, we're able to do this information, which otherwise never existed, and to collect this information for the industry. Next slide. So in the tourism study, yet one more project for which was vital, provided key information that the city of Atascadero, again, stepped up to the plate and helped fund. The piece that I've highlighted in that slide is below in red, and it was on the issue of the airport. The consultant that wrote the tourism study that was, I know, helpful to Atascadero and other cities is that it must the community, the business community in particular, must support this effort. The airlines look to the business community in a way that is vital because 70% of the revenue and the profits come from the business traveler. The other travelers are shop fares much more carefully, and therefore it's much less profit. But if one looks at service, one has to realize that it's unlike postal service, and this is the example that was given to me. You know, the airline industry says, you know, it's not a God-given right. So in other words, if the service is not sustainable and it's not profitable, they won't provide the service. So we're mindful of that, and we know that's important to the community. Next slide. So here's the economic impact of the airport. It's very, very large to the county's economy. 300,000 passengers plus. An overall economic impact, this is direct and indirect, of $177 million every year. But if one looks at if we lost more service, we're losing tourism that come to Atascadero. We're losing tax revenues to the cities, and we're losing impacts to other businesses, and, of course, the higher cost to roads because people aren't flying then. Next slide. Here are some of the proactive community efforts. Richard may want to talk just a minute about this briefly, but it's working. And one evidence of this is this recent SkyWest magazine. It is highlighting all of Slo County. This is a magazine that goes in United Express, SkyWest. Every seat, every pocket gets this magazine. one couldn't pay for this advertising if any one of the tourism organizations in the county could pay for this. It wouldn't be possible. It's very, very valuable. It's valuable to the local economy on a local level. And if you see the magazine, and if you want a copy of it, you can go to the EVC website and download a PDF of this magazine. But it's very exciting. It's exciting because otherwise we're not on the map as a tourism destination without these kinds of efforts. Next slide. So we have the grant. I mentioned that. Next slide. And I think we're at the end here. You know, what can you do? Well, we need support. We need support in the form of letters of support from the cities. We would like the cities to help financially in this program as the best it can. And helping also support the tourism organizations that have provided a tremendous amount of support and time for this effort. So next slide. And there's my contact information. If I could just ask Richard Howell just to come up just very briefly, talk about some of the very exciting things that the airport is doing with Slocata and the EDC.
Madam Mayor, members of the council, good evening. I am Richard Howell. I'm the general manager for airport services for the County of San Luis Obispo. One of the things I'd like to do, Mike did a really great job of talking about the survey, but it was really a very encompassing survey that we did this year. If I could, I'd like to pass these cards down to you. They have our website on it, and the survey results are there. There's also a link to the EVC website. But just real briefly, there's a lot of exciting things going on. The successful communities out there in the world that are actually recruiting air service and retaining the air service they have are offering very substantial and very competitive risk mitigation packages. What you saw in the presentation today kind of overviews what our risk mitigation packages are. As Mike previously mentioned, it wasn't about Slo County, it wasn't about Atascadero, it wasn't about Pismo. It was about management decisions that the airlines were making. One of the items that we didn't talk about here was these carriers that pulled out of here or pulled these services out were running 75-80% load factors on their aircraft when they pulled the aircraft from the market. So it wasn't that they were, you know, they weren't having a good time in Slo and that they didn't want to be. At air service development conferences, our name is coming up as doing the best work on the West Coast. This grant that's coming up, we're very encouraged about what that can do for us, and if we get that grant, we hope to have very positive news very soon. But there's still a lot to do. We have local shares that we need to raise. We have marketing efforts that we and plans that we need to complete and have funding to do that, and that's essentially why we're here talking with you today.
Any questions from the council? Go ahead. Major Pro Tem?
Yes, you mentioned risk mitigation program. Could you explain that further? Is that a pot of money that you hold on to and give to them if they're getting into trouble, or this is an incentive program that you provide to them when they decide to come?
Not to seem flip, but yes. The risk mitigations for the airlines will generally fall into a couple of different categories. One of them is marketing, and we've talked about that already this evening. The second one is the airport waivers for fees. We waive landing fees. We waive terminal rents. And that can add up to a substantial amount of money for an airline. Another item that they have that we presented in the slide are pre-purchase ticket packages. A company can come online and say, you know what, I really do need to go to Sacramento, and I want to buy about $2,000 or $3,000 worth of tickets. And we can actually use that portion of the risk mitigation package to count as our local share should we get the grant, which comes right into the final piece, which is revenue guarantees. That's a difficult thing to get into with the airlines, but some airlines will come to you and say, okay, you know, if we're not doing very well, can you help us out here? That's the principal impact of the grant we applied for $500,000 to be able to go out to an airline and say, okay, we've got your marketing, we've got your fee waivers, we've got other, you know, risk mitigation things available to you. And finally, if you really do get into trouble, we'll enter into some sort of agreement with you where if you need some help with revenue guarantees, we can do that.
Do you see this as a symptom of the economy, or is this something that will continue onward from here on out?
As far as the way the industry has gone, it's been moving this direction for a number of years. The successful communities have risk mitigation packages that may or may not have had revenue guarantees. There may or may not have been multi-million dollar packages. But essentially is what's happening is what Mike alluded to before, and we all saw it in the news last year. The airlines are pulling out their older aircraft. They're parking them on the ground. So there's fewer aircraft out there. There's fewer seats. And there's people just like us in every community going, you know, we really need to do something to get these carriers into our market, and they're going out and doing it. So this is probably a trend we're going to see at least for, I would say, the next 5. And so we're getting what we want. Carrier gets what they want.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well, I'll
go ahead.
Just comment on. I've been our city's representative on the EVC board since I've been on council, and so on behalf of the board, I do want to say how much we've appreciated Mike Manchek's service in the last few years, and we've been leaders in so many areas on these studies, from the wine study, tourism study, airport study, and I think it really has benefited communities. It shows how some regional thinking and economic development can benefit all of us. So thank you, gentlemen, for coming out this evening.
Hey, thank you for that. If I could just say, but sure. In terms of this team effort, clearly, if we can help the countywide economy, we can raise the tide, as they say, lifts all boats, and that is absolutely true. So I would highly encourage you to continue to support your Office of Economic Development. I see on a daily basis the businesses that are talking to us that are being impacted by that, and it is absolutely making a difference. So thank you for that effort as well.
Thank you very much. Great presentation. Okay, we do have a second presentation that's not written on the agenda, but I'm going to give it. It's to recognize our city manager, Wade McKinney. We have a very nice plaque here in honor of 30 years of service to local government, and this is from we call it the ICMA, but it really stands for the International City Management Association. So this is quite a recognition. That's a lot of years in city management.
Yes. I didn't know he was that old.
We said he told me earlier today he started when he was 5. So that you know, you can do the numbers there. Okay, so we're moving on to the consent calendar. And, oh my goodness, I forgot to add how many. We have 8 items on the consent calendar. City Council draft minutes from September 8th, a street closure request for holiday lighting, on-site alcohol sales license, determination of public convenience for Old Camozzi's, oops, I don't know how to pronounce it, Camozzi's Saloon, annual payment of pavement markings award bid, Las Lomas Landscape and Lighting District Landscape Maintenance Services Award, a temporary road closure on Separado Avenue, commitment to California Energy's Commission's Energy Partnership Program, and last. We're moving on to updates from the city manager, Mr. McKinney.
Mayor and council, we're very excited to announce that all of the documents were signed today for the Colony Square project. The Anita Robinson from Mission Bank, the lead bank, is here tonight, as well as the partners, Jim Harrison and Peter Hilf, that are starting the project. We did take some pictures today. The sign is up. Next year, we should all be going to the movies, and we're really excited about that. It is a big project, and so there is going to take a little bit of moving on time. They need to order the equipment or order the materials to start putting the project in. So we're anticipating, we're planning the groundbreaking for November 10th, so that following the groundbreaking, we'll actually have continuous work until we complete the project. So that'll give Specialty Construction time to move on to the site, get material there so they could actually start moving on the project. So November 10th, we'll start getting information out. We'll have a groundbreaking, and we're really excited about it, and I'm sure that that Peter and Jim share our excitement.
Do we need to hear from Peter, Jim, and Anita by any chance?
We can, if you would like to, you could speak now, or you could speak at community forum, whenever you feel more comfortable.
Why don't we do it now?
Now would be great, yeah. If you're ready. I wasn't sure how ready they were.
How about you, Anita?
Welcome. Congratulations.
Well, I'll tell you, this night is a night I've long waited for. We're very excited. I just got off the phone with Rafe Cohen, the president of Galaxy Theaters. He was ecstatic that we signed all the documents today, mutually executed lease. We are ready to go. We are going to bring the theater, the 10-screen theater, that Atascadero has been waiting for. This has been a long process, a lot of ups and downs, but we are 100% going ahead. As Wade McKinney just said, it'll take a week or so to mobilize. Equipment is going to be brought out to the site, and the various subcontractors' contracts will be signed, and of course the materials and stuff will also then start being delivered. We feel that we have about a 10-month length of time of construction, and hopefully everything will be done by then. So theaters are going to be up, and as Wade said, you're going to be able to go to the movies next year. I'd like to just say hello, or introduce my partner again. I know he's not here all the time. I live a little bit closer than he does. He may want to say a few words. And then Anita Robinson, who we could not have gotten this together without, who's the CEO of Mission Bank and was instrumental in putting the consortium of banks together. And Dan Cavanaugh, who's worked in juncture with her on this. And I again want to thank the city staff and the city council for the support that they've given us all this time, and the push over that over the top that they've been able to do for us. I really appreciate that very much. So here's Peter Hilf.
My name is Peter Hilf, and as Jim stated, I'm up here quite often, sometimes not so many times to the meetings. I have a six-year-old daughter, which I'm a single parent, and I have sole physical custody over her, so those things sometimes interfere with the 7 o'clock council meetings. But very briefly, Jim has said most of it, and Anita will mention a couple of things. I have had, since day one, tremendous faith and hope and respect for this community. I think there is a lot of talent in this community. And what I thought, and my strong feelings always have been, that what was missing was some center magnet that would attract all this talent in all kinds of definitions and varieties. Call it a Sunday afternoon for a grandfather or a grandmother, say, well, where do I go? Where do I take my grandkids? Or for a parent to say the same, have the same question. I think Colony Square is the answer to that, and that's what we really hope. We hope to have, like we said, start out with this theater. Hopefully there will be some interesting, exciting restaurants of a sort of variety of foods and definitions to be there. And Colony Square hopefully will be, and not hopefully, I think it will be, the center magnet that will attract all this energy that didn't really have a nucleus to go to. And that's why I personally am so excited about this project. And November 10th, we will be breaking ground. And by within 12 months, call it November of in a year, we're all going to be able to go and start the exciting season, Christmas season, Thanksgiving season, with a beautiful building and this theater operated by really a AAA operator, Galaxy Theater. So thank you very much, and I thank everybody for your support and patience, and thank you.
Good evening. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All righty. I'm here really to answer some of the technical questions that there may be or not. But one of the things I've been saying to Jim and Peter is that now you know what it feels like to give birth, because that's what this project has been like. While certainly all of the anxiety and all of the you know, attention and getting the decision made and bringing the partners together is one piece of it. Getting all, I think we had four, no less than four, maybe five attorneys involved in this process. You have four banks. You have a stack of documents like this. You have many, many players. So I appreciate the patience that the community has had in understanding that this is a complex project. And now what we have done is we've signed the mound of documents. They are in escrow. Everything is lined up for recording and breaking ground and moving on into the celebration of seeing the project come to fruition. And so as the technician in this project, you know, it's been a busy time for us, but I feel as though everything is tied down nice and tidy. Everyone is on the same page, and we're all very excited about getting this project rolling. And then, of course, popcorn and hot dogs and the theater. So, theaters. Any questions that I might answer?
Yes, one is, what might your name be? And what was your response?
Oh, my apologies. Anita Robinson, and I'm the CEO of Mission Community Bank, but I'm also a resident of our fine city of Atascadero.
Well, thanks, Anita.
Yeah.
Your question? Go ahead.
What are you expecting to close escrow?
It will be closing by the end of this week. All the documents are in hand, and we'll be going to escrow in the morning as they've all been signed today. And so we're just lining up because there are a number of banks involved. There's the documents have to go to the banks, and then they then will have to fund into the escrow. And, of course, the funds have to be there the day prior to the closing of the escrow.
Thank you.
Tom? Okay. Well, as mayor, I just want to say thank you for going through all the process, and we're looking forward to seeing the
thank you.
Theaters
thank
come
you
to
for
fruition.
Your support.
An important day for all of us. Okay, next item is community forum. Community forum, and this is for items that are not on the agenda. And I don't know, do we have our minister?
Could you let the pastor go first?
Usually
ma'am?
We have the minister go first.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I don't recognize you. I'm sorry.
Steve Shively, welcome.
Thank you. Good to see you guys tonight. I am Steve Shively, a pastor at Calvary Chapel here in town, and I'm here to pray, kind of representing the Ministerial Association. Before I do that, I did want to just share a couple things. We know I had Colony Days about 3 weeks ago, and we had our booth out there again this year and gave away a couple thousand bottles of water. And just from my viewpoint, I thought the parade route and everything was just great and seemed like it put more people downtown. Also, this Saturday night is October 31st, and our church this year, again, is having a harvest party, an alternative to the trick-or-treating. And this year we're having several carnival booths, giant slide, bounce houses, a jousting ring for the teenagers, paintball, shooting range, music, free food. So much candy, we need to get it out of the office. So just want to invite everyone in the community out to that. Everything is free, and it's from 5:30 to 8:30. And we are located at 6955 Portola Road, just off of Morrill Road. So everyone's welcome to come out to that. So at this point, I want to pray. And if anyone wants to join me, you're welcome to. Heavenly Father, we just praise you tonight, and we thank you for all of your goodness, for your many blessings. We thank you, Lord, for putting us in this beautiful community, God, to live, to God, to breathe in, and to raise our families in. We're just asking for your blessing on us, and we pray that you bless our city council, Lord. We thank you for these servants. We pray that you give them wisdom and just guidance and direction in the things they're doing. And Lord, we acknowledge, God, even according to Romans 13, Lord, that you've put them in this place to govern in this city. So again, just bless them and keep them, and just bless this meeting tonight, God. We pray for everyone who would speak, that you give them clarity, and you know, God, give us ears to hear and to wisdom to make good decisions. So just pray all these things, Lord, in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Thank you.
Welcome.
Nothing like jumping the gun, especially in front of God. That's a bad thing. My apologies again. I'm on my way to a meeting, so I was a little anxious, and I apologize. I wanted to tell you how extraordinarily excited and proud I am to be here before this city council and this city staff as the secretary for the Veterans Memorial Foundation. It is almost a year since we dedicated something that was begun in 2006, and to great credit of the several of the foundation members, the foundation members, but also of the city council. I know Tom O'Malley has been behind the building of a veterans memorial for a long time, as was Jerry Clay and Leroy Dodge, another fine member of our community. We are about to celebrate the first anniversary of the Faces of Freedom Veterans Memorial, and we'll be doing that on November 11th in celebration of Veterans Day. It'll be at 11 o'clock, and this tradition would have it, 11 o'clock on the 11th day of the 11th month. And what's different about this year, besides the fact that the memorial is completed, is that the traditional Veterans Day ceremony, which is normally held out at the cemetery, will be held for the first time in 40 years someplace else. So we're very honored to have that. But I wanted to thank this council. I certainly wanted to thank the city staff, all of you who have helped so much through the last years, and we've been through a lot. So I appreciate that. On that day, it will begin at 11 a.m. There will be a ceremony for somewhere between 30 to 45 minutes. There will be a flyover provided to us by Estrella Warbirds. Guest speaker will be a Colonel Tony Woods, retired United States Marine Corps. Very fine speaker, and we're very proud to have him. In addition, we'll be presenting for the first time the Distinguished Veterans Award for SLO County. So we'd like very much to invite all of you to attend. There'll be a barbecue to follow with our good friends at the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the VFW, just down the street. And so I would cordially invite you to please patronize their facility as well. So unless you have any questions, again, thank you so much for all the support. Tascadero is certainly moving in a phenomenal direction and with great speed. Very proud to hear about all the new and future endeavors that the city is undertaking. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Light's green. Is it on? Good evening. My name is Mitch Paskin. I live on San Marcos Road, up around 500 yards from the entrance to Oak Ridge Estates. And that's the subject of my little foyer here to the community forum. Oak Ridge Estates is going to have eventually, it's planned to have 107 homes out at the end of San Marcos Road. Right now, 25 have already been built. According to the EIR that was done in 1994, there's going to be 888 daily trips in and out of Oak Ridge Estates. And that doesn't count the residents that live on Route 2 and from Oak Ridge Estates. Right now, there's only one entrance. It starts at Highway 41 at Los Altos Road. It travels up Los Altos to San Marcos Road and then out San Marcos to the entrance to the project. Those roads are 21 feet wide. It's called the Rural Hillside Local. Many of the curves in that road are outside city specifications. Some of the curve widening is outside city specifications. Eventually, there's going to be a second road built. It's supposed to be done prior to phase two of the project. It's going to go down a very steep grade, from what I was told, 17% grade, which is outside of city specifications, with radius turns of 70 feet, several of those, which are way outside city specifications. There is a third way into the project. It is called Escobroso Road. That right now has, according to what was originally planned in 1994 when the EIR was done, they abandoned Escobroso Road out to Highway 41, a direct route. It's my interest to have that road reestablished and be built from the project out to 41. There's concerns about traffic. There's concerns about safety. There's concerns from my neighbors about what's going to happen in an emergency situation with the very narrow roads and the long distance to the highway. There's been damage done to the road that hasn't been repaired. And so I'm going to be here at the city council meetings laying all this stuff out. We're going to look at some of the EIR. We're going to look at the plan development overlay, which is part of the municipal code. And hopefully we're going to look at some of the approvals that have been carried on in the city, of the planning commission, the city council over time. So my time's up, and I really love the movies, and I can't wait for next summer. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, and thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Ron Uchelson. I'm Associate Administrator at Sierra Vista Regional Medical Center, and I'm here tonight to seek your advocacy for the County Board of Supervisors to adopt a trauma plan in San Luis Obispo County to include one Level 2 trauma center. And for the past 35 years, Sierra Vista has been serving this community as the unofficial or de facto trauma center, and including this community as well. The purpose of a designated trauma center is to increase survival rates and improve patient outcomes by transporting those patients to the most appropriate hospital in the shortest amount of time. That doesn't mean that all the trauma is going to come to one trauma center. To the contrary, most of what goes to hospitals today will continue to go to those very same hospitals. There are some patients that very appropriately need to get to the right hospital in the shortest amount of time. About a year and a half ago, the county EMSA hired a consultant to provide an objective assessment of trauma in our county, and startlingly, the assessment came back that there are delays in care in our county anywhere from 2 to 19 hours. And for patients who could have gone directly to a trauma center. That same consultant also concluded that only about 2 patients per month might be diverted away from each of the other facilities in the county. A subsequent look at the data a year later showed that that data still stayed pretty right on. There may have been one additional trip that was coming countywide, but it's pretty much of a minimal impact. So the ultimate goal for a trauma system is to improve patient outcomes by minimizing these treatment delays. Research has concluded that patient outcomes are improved when a greater number of seriously injured patients are taken to just one facility. Hospitals incur tremendous costs and expense to provide trauma services. This includes things such as a comprehensive physician call panel by way of explanation. Sierra Vista spends in excess of $3 million a year to keep physicians on call to its ER. Additional staffing, additional equipment, and additional data collection, including education and training of our staff. Sierra Vista has already made this investment. We could become a trauma center tomorrow if the county gives the go-ahead for a trauma system. And that's why it's important to support the highest level of trauma in the county, which is level 2, rather than having multiple hospitals all try to provide trauma. Trauma systems have been in place since the Korean War, the MASH units. Those were basically trauma units. And so they've been in place since the Korean War. And San Luis Obispo, surprisingly, is the last county in the state of California without an organized trauma plan. We urge you to advocate for the best and most appropriate care of the citizens of our county and of your community by supporting our desire to become the first officially designated trauma center in San Luis Obispo County. Our neurosurgery capability, the only one in the county, just steps up our ability to provide these tertiary services that no other hospital area is capable of, and that makes Sierra Vista the logical choice to be the trauma center in the county of San Luis Obispo. So with that, thank you for your time. I'm going to leave a copy.
I do have a couple of council questions.
Certainly.
So, Councilmember Clay.
I want to plant a seed, if it's all right.
Absolutely.
Okay. About 25 years ago, my son had a very serious head injury in Tustin, California, and his brain was swollen and so on, and he was near death. And the last resort, they put him in a decompression chamber. And that did the trick. And I know they don't have one down at Sierra Vista. And so I want to plant a seed. I think it's a great thing. You know, it takes the pressure off the brain. And so
well, not to give away too many of our strategies, but we certainly are looking at hyperbaric oxygen, which is not available currently in this county.
Right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
So if you're designated as the trauma level 2, does that make you more available to receive funding to have this specialty equipment, or
the answer to that is no. The first step is to have the Board of Supervisors, and it should go to them in November, December, to say that we want a trauma system. That's step one. We currently don't have an updated trauma system. What will happen then is an RFP will be sent out to all the hospitals to see who wants to participate in trauma. Sierra Vista is the only hospital capable of level 2 trauma based on our tertiary services that we receive. There is no real government funding for this. There could be, and we haven't, to be honest with you, this isn't about money. This is about appropriate care for our community. There could be some additional monies in some of our managed care contracts that would pay something extra mm-hmm. for something that's designated trauma. A case that's designated trauma, and physicians could have some additional reimbursement too for treating those traumas as well.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonsi.
Mr. Ubelson, when you came to the podium, you stated you're asking for our advocacy. Could you explain what you are asking us as a city to do?
That if the Board of when it comes time for the Board of Supervisors to have this on their agenda, if they come to the various, you know, what we suspect, you know, might happen is they'll come to various communities and say, you know, do you support the concept of trauma? Some, you know, communities might be more advocate for their, you know, for the hospital that's closest to their community. Twin Cities Community Hospital, which is probably much closer to Atascadero than San Luis Obispo, is our sister hospital, and they very much are behind Sierra Vista providing that level 2 trauma. So if the I guess when we're asking for your advocacy, if there are questions from the Board of Supervisors, or if you would be, you know, so kind as to proactively send a letter to the Board of Supervisors saying that you advocate for a trauma system. We're not asking you to advocate for trauma for Sierra Vista. We're asking you just to ask the Board of Supervisors to approve the fact that we should have an organized trauma plan, an organized trauma system in this county.
Thank you.
I could absolutely support that.
Councilman O'Malley.
Thank you. And I would encourage you to send us additional information, background, and help us support that. I, too, would support that we get behind the trauma plan and having a system in our county. Health care is very important to our population, and I think we'd want to follow through on that. So I think if we don't want to ask our staff outside of their area of expertise to do a lot of extra work, but I think if you could
get information
to all of us council members through the city clerk, I would like to take a look at it and consider.
It sounds like we're
all right.
Would support
well, thank
that.
You very much. I've left a copy of the publicly available consultant's report. I will mail each of you individually that copy of it as well, and thank you very much for your time tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we all have family members, friends, family that we would always want them to have the best care. Thank you, and welcome.
And I think, is this on? It has a green light. Okay, there's this note here. Anyway, I am Eric Greening, and I'm actually going to tell you some of the things I was planning to tell you 2 weeks ago when we were getting much-needed rainfall in a rather dramatic way, and you wisely chose not to meet. But I was going to share... I was going to say this is official Arts Month, the month of October. I was going to share my delight that Colony Days had an arts focus this year, specifically the art of music. I was going to recommend that everyone visit our local artists during 2 weekends of open studios, the North County weekend and the Encore weekend. I was going to point out that our local artists had donated their talents and time to the creation of some absolutely memorable chairs, which were to be auctioned off at Red Tree Gallery for the support of our library expansion. I was going to tell you all of those things in the future tense. They have all happened, but I can tell you in the present tense, the past tense, and the future tense that the artists are a very, very important resource in our community, and that we should continue to support them. And one date that is in the future tense will be December 4th, when there will be another art and wine walk through the downtown and other parts of town, wherever our local artists are showing. And simply to give my recommendation that if you celebrate Christmas or any other holiday at which gift-giving is traditional, the best gifts, both for our economy and just to honor our community character, is art by local artists, CDs by local musicians, books by local authors. If you're giving to a local person, it helps them realize the riches we have locally. If you're giving to someone from far away, it helps them realize what a special place you're living in and feel good about the place you live. And so I hope we continue with every month being Arts Month and doing all we can to care for our local artists, because they are not a corporation where the profit goes to distant stockholders. They are not going to be subject to some distant boardroom business decision to pull them out of our community and put something somewhere else where the wages are lower. They are here. They are among us, and they are creating quality of life as well as economic activity. Thank you.
Mr. Greening, you did mean to include photographers as well,
didn't you? Of course, visual artists of all kinds, photographers. And we have a beautiful gallery just out of our city limits, the Black and White Gallery, that also deserves notice. Thank you.
And Eric, let me just clarify. So December 4th is going to be, is that a Friday evening?
That it will be a Friday evening. I believe it's 5:30 to 8:30.
5:30 to 8:30. So it's a great way to spend your after hours on that final Friday when you're finally getting ready for the weekend.
And if we're mentioning photographers, of course, I have to mention our living treasure, 96-year-old Joe Schwartz. It's an honor to have him a resident of our community.
It is.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Mayor, members of the City Council, my name is Chuck Ward. I live here in Atascadero, and I'm a Marine Corps veteran. Early November is a very special day for veterans, not only here in Atascadero, but all around the world. Starting with November 10, as you know, it's a special day here in Atascadero, and it seems ironic, maybe good karma, that on November 10, in the year 1775, the Continental Congress founded the Marine Corps. And since that time, on every November 10, around the world, whether it's in an outpost in Afghanistan or any one of the embassies around the world where the American flag flies, or down in Pensacola where our police chief's daughter is going to be on November 10, the Marine Corps celebrates his birthday. In this part of the world, we're having this celebration on November 7 at the Veterans Memorial in San Luis Obispo. This is not just an event by special invitation only. It's open to the public, veterans, veteran supporters. It is formal. Chance to see a lot of sharp-looking Marines in their dress blues and medals. I'll be there. I can't fit into my dress blues anymore, so I'll be wearing a tuxedo. But this is a marvelous event. It's a chance to see something that approaches Camelot. It's a very wonderful ceremony. Those that are interested in the dinner, you can call Betty Cook. She's organizing this. She's a lady Marine veteran. Phone number 541-0456. There's another event coming up, the Elks have asked me to announce that they're having their traditional Veterans Recognition Dinner on the evening, 5 o'clock, on November 11 at the Elks Lodge. Dinner's $10. Events start at 5 o'clock. And if you're interested in going, tickets are going fast. Their number is 466-3557. Finally, there's a church here in Atascadero that's having a motorcycle Poker Run fundraiser event on November 11 to sponsor the wonderful, wonderful charity Loaves and Fishes. The organizer, his name is Nick Perdon. His phone number, 462-3548. It's going to be a wonderful week for veterans, and I know it's a great week for Tuscadero groundbreaking on this long overdue wonderful project. Thank you.
And Chuck, I just, on behalf of all of our council, we wanted to thank you for your service and also for your long, hard service on the Veterans Memorial Project. You were a major fundraiser there, and we appreciate your service in our community on behalf of all of us, I know.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good evening. I'll try to give you a quick recap on Colony Days so you can get on with your agenda tonight. This last weekend, we had a very satisfying and very successful Colony Days celebration. The theme was Strike Up the Band, and we did that. We had 8 bands in the parade. Lots of excitement. I think much greater attendance along the parade route. The new parade route was very successful. We've had lots of positive feedback about that, so we feel very good about that. We had the field show competition up at the high school where the bands drew a totally new audience from communities outside of this area, and that was very successful also. Great interface with city staff, particularly with Marsha Torgerson and with Officer Caleb Davis. They were really great in helping us through the areas that we had to make things work with the city, and with all these bands coming in and with traffic and whatnot, it was challenging at moments, but with their help we managed to get through it. We had many, many contributors this year, but 3 that I really need to mention because they are far and away the largest contributors money-wise to supporting this event and the expanded roster of activities we had. The Atascadero Main Street Association, between supporting the field show, supporting street closure fees and awards, contributed almost $6,000 to the Colony Days event this year. I know the Rotary Club also contributed, I believe, about $3,000. And San Lucia Bank, with their annual golf tournament, put $2,000 in. And with all this and all the many other contributors and sponsors we had a successful Colony Days financially. And we want to thank everybody, not just those folks, but everybody that helped make Colony Days so successful and help pay for all those bills. Tremendous amount of volunteers this year. We probably had close to 200 people working the event, including large contingents from the Grizzly Academy and from Griffin House, and quite simply, it couldn't have been pulled off without them. There's just a lot of toting and caring that goes on for Colony Days, and without those folks, it wouldn't have happened. We've already had our post-event dissection meeting, a long list of improvements for next year. We are starting the planning and fundraising and budgeting and all the other activities associated with Colony Days for 2010 right now. There won't be a cessation of activities until next year. We will continue on with the committee meetings and getting next year's event online and ready to go. So for everybody who helped with Colony Days, thank you. I think it was really great activity, and we all had a good time. Before I retreat into the audience, a couple of things coming up. December 4th has already been mentioned, but in addition to the art and wine tour that night, that's the night of the tree lighting ceremony downtown, and we'll be opening the new Christmas castle on Entrada. So we want everybody to come down and take a look at that. And on December the 11th, Winter Wonderland, and this year we're planning 5 blocks of entertainment plus some 50 tons of snow. We're going to be doubling our budget this year, which is ambitious, so we're out looking for sponsors right now, and anybody that would like to help out with that, they can contact the Atascadero Main Street office. Thank you.
Councilman Clay?
Hold on. First off, you know, I saw you at Colony Days, and I said, you know, what a great job you did, and you stopped me right there, and you said, hey, wait a minute, you know, and you mentioned these 200 volunteers, they got to have a leader, though, and I thought you did a heck of a job. I don't know, it was one of the best Colony Days that I've ever been to, and, you know, I'd like to acknowledge Maggie Vandergon, too, for getting it started, and Maggie's hung in there all the way, but this was a great Colony Days, a good parade route, the music was great in the park, the weather was great, and one other thing I wanted to mention is the work that Jimmy Wilkins has done on the Historical Society, what do you call it, Colony?
Absolutely. They have the Colony House down there where the museum has been relocated since right. They were moved out of the big administration building. And I meant to mention that for the first time in a long time, the Historical Society got quite involved in Colony Days, teamed up with Tent City, so there's traffic flow from Tent City into the museum area and vice versa. On the morning of Colony Days, they had between 200 and 300 people go through the Colony Museum. A lot of people who didn't even know that place existed now do.
Well, and, you know, Tent City was outstanding, and, you know, Jimmy Wilkins, you know, the historical society there did a great job, and people need to go there. I mean, I was shocked when I went in, and the patio in the back is just beautiful. So, folks, please make it a point to go through the you know, the historical society building there and see what they've done. And it's really, it brought back a lot of memories to me. I tell you, I saw a lot of pictures there that just really brought back a lot of memories. But
all about the history of Atascadero, and I think that was really brought out well this year.
Absolutely, Tom, you have anything?
I was going to mention, I thought the bands was great. Is it, I'm sure everybody liked that, and we can expect bands again next year?
Yes, or? In fact, we worked with the Athletic Foundation to bring the bands in this year, and in our post-event meeting, we were discussing the fact that we need to get out right now and get the word back to these bands to bring them back next year rather than wait for school to adjourn for the summer vacation, because it leaves a very brief window of planning if we wait till September to get these bands on board. Also, we talked about capacity. We had 8 bands in the parade this year. We would like to have more in the future. And as near as we can tell right now, without building all sorts of parking lots, we can probably accommodate about 15 to 20 bands if we can recruit that many. So we're looking towards expanding that in the future.
Because I'm sure there's a lot of positive talking going on out there on how exciting it was to have all those bands. And
yes,
we can really draw a lot of people into our community, and they can see what we're all about. So good job, Steve.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. I think that was our last speaker for Community Forum. So go ahead and close that, and we move on to public hearings. First one tonight is a report on the moratorium on the establishment and operation of medical marijuana facilities and a draft ordinance prohibiting medical marijuana facilities. We'll start out with any ex parte communications. Anyone? Seeing no one, none, and we'll move to our staff report from our city attorney. Go ahead, Mr. Pirick.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. This is a report on a moratorium on the establishment and operation of medical marijuana facilities, and also presented for your consideration as a draft ordinance prohibiting medical marijuana facilities. In 1996, the voters of California approved the initiative known as the Compassionate Use Act of 1996, also referred to as Proposition 215. It authorized, under certain circumstances, the use of medical marijuana. Despite the passage of Proposition 215, medical marijuana does not, and the medical necessity, is still prohibited by federal law. And there have been recent statements by the current federal administration with respect to not enforcing that federal law. However, it is still a violation of federal law. This report that is being presented to you this evening is pursuant to Government Code Section 65858D, which is required in connection with the extension of this moratorium ordinance. In addition to the fact that medical marijuana facilities are in violation of federal law, another factor to consider in evaluating what actions you may be taking this evening is that medical marijuana facilities have reported, and there have been reported by law enforcement agencies, increases in illegal drug activity in the vicinities of such facilities, illegal drug sales, robbery of persons leaving dispensaries, loitering around dispensaries, and falsely obtaining identification cards and other criminal activity. In the staff report, I make reference to certain white papers that have been prepared that provide additional detail with regard to these so-called secondary effects and the increases in criminal activities around medical marijuana facilities. One of those papers is the white paper that was prepared by the California Police Chiefs Association. That's attachment 2. That was in 2007. The California Police Chiefs Association also in 2009 prepared a white paper on medical marijuana facilities. And in addition to that, the County of Riverside District Attorney's Office, this is attachment 4, in 2006, prepared a white paper. I call it a white paper. It's basically a report that's based upon the investigation and studies that were conducted by those respective agencies, and each of them found that there were problems associated with medical marijuana facilities. I could refer you to the top of page 55 of the staff report, where the police chiefs make reference in their white paper to reports of serious criminal activity in the vicinity of medical marijuana facilities, including, quote, robberies, assaults, burglaries, the sale of illegal drugs, murder, and attempted murder. Moreover, continuing to quote, increased noise and pedestrian traffic, including non-residents in pursuit of marijuana and out-of-area criminals in search of prey, are commonly encountered just outside medical marijuana dispensaries, as well as drug-related offenses. In addition to the issues with regards to the federal law and the secondary effects, as I mentioned in the staff report, there is also the potential, according to the California Police Chiefs Association report, that a city or county which establishes or permits the establishment of dispensaries could have potential liability because they are arguably aiding and abetting in criminal violations of federal law. We are not aware, as I mentioned in the report, of any cities or counties that have been prosecuted for aiding and abetting, but it certainly is a risk that I wanted to bring to your attention. In the report, I note that the ordinances within the various cities of San Luis Obispo County, the other six cities in the county, have ordinances which prohibit medical marijuana facilities. I also make reference to the city of El Cerrito and a report that they did with regards to medical marijuana facilities, finding that they're in violation of federal law, mentioning the secondary effects. At page 57 of the staff report, I referenced the city of Norwalk and the study that they did and their conclusions with regards to the criminal activities surrounding these facilities. In addition, attachment 19 in your package, which appears at page, beginning at page 265, which is also a PowerPoint slide that's on the board and displayed now, is a survey which the city received, City of Tascadero received about October 1 of 2009. The city of Redding had conducted this survey, and as you can see, the names of the cities are on the left, and then there are columns that go from left to right with respect to what those cities do in terms of medical marijuana facilities. It goes from permitted use, discretionary use, moratorium, prohibition, and a ban. And I counted the number of cities that were responsive to this survey. You don't see all 50 on this slide, but as we go through the slide, you'll find that there are. Of the 50 cities that we're going to see here, nine of them are in categories one and two, namely the permitted use and the discretionary permit. Seven of them have a moratorium, and 34 of them have ordinances which ban medical marijuana facilities. Can we have the next slide, please? There we have additional cities as they are shown before you. There is a duplication for the city of Irvine. They have a ban, and they also, I guess, reported in the survey that they will not issue a business license for this use. Next slide, please. There we have more cities. Again, you can see they're spread out throughout the state. Paso Robles is one of the cities, as well as San Luis Obispo County. I mentioned that the six other cities in San Luis Obispo County have bans on medical marijuana facilities. The county itself does allow medical marijuana dispensaries based on a discretionary permit. Next slide. I believe this is the last one. Yes, it is. And we see here, again, the pattern, as I mentioned before, only a handful of cities allow medical marijuana facilities. This slide is typical of the others that you've seen, where the overwhelming majority of cities either have a moratorium on such facilities or an outright ban. So before you this evening, I've made two recommendations, the first of which is that the city adopt as an interim urgency ordinance extending the current moratorium through September 8th of 2010 for the establishment and operation of medical marijuana facilities. There would be a moratorium on them. And secondly, to refer to the Planning Commission for consideration a draft ordinance to repeal existing ordinances regarding medical marijuana and to adopt an ordinance prohibiting the establishment and operation of medical marijuana facilities in the city of Atascadero. I've prepared a draft ordinance that's in your packet as attachment 18, and it's beginning at page 258 of your materials. I prepared that draft ordinance based upon my review of ordinances of other cities. I included some additional information that I thought was appropriate. I have the findings set forth in the draft ordinance, as well as the definition of what constitutes a medical marijuana facility, the penalties for violation. I also included a civil injunction provision that will allow us to enjoin those. And basically, since this would involve zoning, it needs to be referred to the Planning Commission for them to review the draft ordinance and then make a recommendation to the council as to whether to adopt the ordinance or not. The council could, in terms of alternative actions, not take any of the actions that are recommended here and allow the current moratorium to expire. You could also adopt the current moratorium or extend the current moratorium through September of 2010 without referring the ordinance that would ban marijuana to the Planning Commission. Or if you were to follow both recommendations that are in the report, you extend the moratorium until September 2010 and you refer the draft ban ordinance to the Planning Commission. So I think that's it in a nutshell. I'm certainly prepared to respond to questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Pierrick. Very excellent and very extensive report. I don't know if anyone had a chance to look at that online. It's over 250 pages. Any questions for Mr. Pierrick? Councilmember O'Malley.
And you may have addressed this, but in your opinion, with recent changes in the federal government's discussion of their will to enforce existing law, does that impact any of this of your report, in your opinion?
It does not, for two reasons. First of all, notwithstanding the fact that the current administration is electing not to enforce the federal law, medical marijuana facilities are still a violation of federal law. And the second is that the recommendation that's coming to you, even if medical marijuana facilities were permitted by federal law, you have the other consideration of the negative secondary effects that are impacted by the medical marijuana facilities. I provided in your packet copies of the ordinances from the other cities in the county, and I reviewed those carefully as well as ordinances from other cities, and virtually every ordinance that I've seen makes reference to the fact that one of the significant reasons motivating the cities to adopt either moratoriums or bans on such facilities is those negative secondary effects, the increases in criminal activity, drug sales, smoking of marijuana in front of children from the folks that are leaving these facilities, buying marijuana at these facilities and then selling it to others who don't have the medical marijuana recommendation from their doctor. It's detailed in the report.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no more questions, I'll open it to the public. And please state your name for the record. And each speaker has 3 minutes. Welcome.
Hello. My name is Scott Ziering. I am a 20-year resident of this county. I am employed full-time, and I'm registered to vote here in Atascadero. And I'm a medical marijuana patient. I'm here to ask you to repeal this ban, and I've got 3 points that I'd like to make to explain my request. My first point concerns crime in the dispensary. My second point is that you will not be arrested if there is a problem. And third, that the Schedule 1 classification of marijuana is wrong and people are suffering because of it. Everyone is concerned about crime being created by or happening around a dispensary. And I understand that you're being told by law enforcement that there are problems in LA, and that's why we need to ban medical marijuana here. While some people are taking advantage of medical marijuana, most people in the medical marijuana community are just trying to live our lives, and we want and need a safe and reliable source for our medicine. It is unjust to hold the entire medical marijuana community responsible for the criminal actions of others. When a pharmacy in a high-crime area of Los Angeles or San Francisco gets robbed, we don't call for a ban on our local Walgreens. When an employee steals pills or a person sells their prescription on the side, we don't arrest the CEO of the pharmaceutical company, shut down the pharmacy, and deny others their medication. Yet this is exactly how members of the medical marijuana community are treated. Someone else breaks the law, and we are indirectly punished and forced to suffer. This ban reinforces that treatment. This brings me to my second point. City council members are not going to be arrested if the law is broken. No member of government has ever been held responsible for the existence of a dispensary, and only the operators and employees are ever arrested. Furthermore, the current administration under Obama has issued new policy guidelines to federal prosecutors to allow medical marijuana dispensaries as long as state and local laws are obeyed. And that brings me to my third point. I'd like to explain why, as a member of the medical marijuana community, I am participating in civil disobedience by using marijuana, even though it is banned federally. Marijuana has medicinal value. There are 7 people currently receiving FDA-approved medical marijuana in the United States under the Compassionate Investigational New Drug Study. In the 3 decades since this program was founded, it has shown conclusively that smoked marijuana has medicinal use and that the benefits far outweigh the risk. The federal law is incongruous at best and must be updated to reflect current scientific research. It is cruel to force any more people to suffer while waiting for the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. to catch up. Please show your leadership skills by helping us in this struggle and repeal this ban. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi. My name is Melissa Ziering, and I've resided in this county for 27 years. I'm a medical marijuana patient. I'd like to share with you why I choose medical marijuana over prescription medications for the migraine headaches that I often suffer from. First, I'd like to state that the federal Schedule 1 classification of marijuana is wrong. Marijuana does have medicinal value. When I get a migraine headache, the pain in my head is excruciating and unbearable. So first I tried taking Tylenol, Advil. That did nothing, absolutely nothing for me. And so I went to the doctor and she prescribed me Emetrex. After 45 minutes after taking the pill, it finally started to take effect, and after I still vomited, I still felt seasick, and I wasn't able to function properly. Then I went back to my doctor, and she prescribed me medical marijuana. And I took that, and I mean, I was able to function. I was able to lift my head up from the pain that I was feeling, you know, and go on with my day. So I started researching the side effects of the medications, and this is what I found. I discovered that acetaminophen overdose is one of the leading causes of liver failure in the United States. Then I found that even lifelong marijuana users have never shown any signs of major organ damage, and there's never been a fatality from marijuana use. If my daughter, for some reason, were to take like my Tylenol or my Advil or even my Emetrex, she would die. She would absolutely die. You know, but if she got into my medical marijuana, which, you know, I do keep all that stuff locked up, but just for some reason, if she did get a hold of it, you know, if she got out of the body, sudden headache, confusion, problems with speech or vision, or balance, severe stomach pain and bloody diarrhea and seizures. The less serious is nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, muscle pain, warmth or redness under the skin, pressure or heavy feeling in any part of your body, sneezing, runny nose, congestion, cough, dizziness, sleepiness, drooling, or sweating. I'm going to conclude by saying that I'm not a criminal. I'm a functioning part of society. I'm a wife. I'm a mother. I have a full-time job, and I fulfill my everyday responsibilities without skipping a beat. I'm sorry. Would you please consider allowing the dispensary to come into our community so I have access to my medications? And I also like to say that, you know, every time I've gone down to the dispensaries, never once has anybody ever come up to me propositioning me to buy them marijuana. Never once have I been robbed. You know, the people that work there are professional. You know, I walk in, I show them my ID, my prescription is already in their file. I go in the door, I'm locked inside. So if there was a robbery, you know, they would just call 911, and the person outside the bulletproof glass that they sit behind would just be arrested. So, I mean, it's just a very professional environment, you know, and I've never been reckless. I've never, you know, done anything stupid. I just use it for my medication, you know, and it helps me immensely.
Thank you.
So,
your time is up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was trying to let you finish up. Thank you.
Good evening again. I'm Eric Greening. I'm not a medical marijuana patient, but I am a person with epilepsy who reacted very badly to anticonvulsants, the standard medication. And I'm fortunate enough to have had access to and to have responded well to biofeedback training so that I could go medication-free. Not everyone with epilepsy would respond well to biofeedback training. Not everyone has an aura with enough advance warning before a seizure to be able to do the things that we have no vocabulary for, but that you learn to do in biofeedback training. I have friends with epilepsy who can control their seizures in no other way. Dilantin and Mycelin did not control my seizures. Now, cannabis users, they have the word stoned. I don't know. When there were anticonvulsants in my brain, epilepsy, people with intractable pain, people with migraines, people with cancer, who only eat because this particular medication gives them their appetite back. Now, as was stated by a previous speaker, if there were equal protection of the law and you wanted to ban dispensaries, you would also ban all pharmacies, because every pharmacy deals in substances that would instantly become illegal drugs if they were redealt on the street. You're not monitoring to see that this isn't so. I'm not suggesting that you close pharmacies. I'm simply suggesting equal protection of the law. And I'm suggesting further that rather than extend this moratorium, that you do some research with the cities that have been surveyed and other cities in California that are in the category of having a discretionary permit. Find out which cities do and don't have the negative side effects of the dispensaries that have been reported here, which are having those problems and which are not having those problems, and then look at what are the ingredients in the discretionary permits of the cities that are not reporting those problems, so that we could actually be compassionate to people who need all kinds of medication. Thank you.
Welcome.
Good evening. My name is Warren J. Sarvis III. I wasn't planning on speaking today, amongst other reasons, because I'm a horrible speaker. But I'm a medical marijuana patient, and I'm up here today to ask you to repeal this ban on the ordinance. All I can tell you is that I've been to dispensary facilities and have nothing but positive experience from them. No crime, no one approaching me, just a wonderful experience with the staff, professional people. I also use a delivery service that is incredibly professional. And I just think that people being able to have access to their medical marijuana is a much better option than prescription medication. I had an ex-wife, and you know, she got so into prescription medications that
draft a permanent ban. But I'm actually not here to argue the value of marijuana as a possible medication, because I actually do believe in it. I have some family members that use medical marijuana, and I'm not also going to deny the need to have compassion on people that need medical marijuana. I don't even think that needs to be argued. What I am here to discuss is the need of whether or not we need to have a pot store here in Atascadero. We have all, during the budget debates, we discussed our police force being pushed to its limit, you know, whether or not that they can be at one end of town at the same time they're at the other end of town. Our teenagers basically not even having the police force being stretched, and our teenagers stretching them. the county of San Luis Obispo allows these dispensaries without a problem, and there can be one opened in Santa Margarita, Templeton, and many other towns that are nearby. This would allow all of these people in need to obtain their marijuana without having to actually open one here in Atascadero. 34 out of 50 cities didn't ban these dispensaries because they aren't a problem. And I just don't think we need one more problem here in Atascadero. Thank you.
Welcome.
Good evening. My name is Len Colomarino. I have a couple of questions about the moratorium. I read last week an article in, I think it was the LA Times, referring to a court decision that was rendered that, as I understood it, enjoined the moratorium that had been adopted by Los Angeles on medical marijuana facilities. Excuse me. The article said that the decision would be released within a couple of days, and it hadn't been released yet. I haven't seen any follow-up on that, but I just want to raise that point. Particularly, the question would be how the moratorium that was invalidated in Los Angeles would differ materially from the moratorium that the council is being asked to adopt to ensure that there won't be any problem here. Now, on that point, too, as I recall, I think the law says that to have this kind of a moratorium, there has to be a finding of a, I think it was clear and immediate threat to the public safety. Clear and immediate are the words I remember, and I seem to recall a threat or danger. It might be a good idea to get that in the record clearly, because as we see from the Los Angeles example, the moratoriums do get challenged at times, and courts do strike them down. Thank you.
Seeing no one else approach the podium, I'll bring it back to the council for discussion. Councilman O'Malley?
Before you go there,
Ask you to follow up on that, because I know you've reviewed that, so please go ahead.
We'll go ahead and let Mr. Pirick respond to public comment.
Yes, one of the speakers questioned the issue of criminal activity surrounding medical marijuana facilities and suggested that this was a problem limited to Los Angeles and San Francisco. I would refer you to the white paper that was prepared by the California Police Officers Association. This is at page, the California Police Chiefs Association. This is at page 102 of your packet. And I'm quoting under category A, which is entitled Armed Robberies and Murders. Quote, throughout California, many violent crimes, let me repeat that, throughout California, many violent crimes have been committed that can be traced to proliferation of medical marijuana dispensaries. These include armed robberies and murders. For example, as far back as 2002, two home occupants were shot in Willits, California, in the course of a home invasion targeting medical marijuana. And a series of four armed robberies of medical marijuana dispensaries in Santa Barbara, and I don't think that's in Los Angeles, California, occurred through August 10, 2006, in which $30 and 15 baggies filled with marijuana on display were taken by force and removed from the premises in the latest holdup. The owner said he failed to report the first three robberies because, quote, medical marijuana is such a controversial issue. Let me refer you to page 152 to 153 of the staff report. This is the white paper that was prepared by the District Attorney's Office for the County of Riverside. And in that study, they studied areas throughout the state. Page 152, the heading is Secondary Effects of Dispensaries and Similarly Operating Cooperatives. I'm quoting now. Of equal concern are the secondary effects of these dispensaries and storefront cooperatives throughout the state. Let me repeat, throughout the state, many violent crimes have been committed that can be traced to their proliferation. These crimes included robberies, assaults, burglaries, murders, and attempted murders. At the bottom of page 7, medical marijuana storefront businesses have allowed criminals to flourish in California. This past summer, the city of San Diego cooperated with federal authorities and served search warrants on several medical marijuana locations. In addition to marijuana, many weapons were recovered, including a stolen handgun and an M16 assault rifle. Now, I've only quoted a few of the passages from this 200-plus page report that I filed. There was also a comment by one of the speakers about there not being sufficient evidence in the record. Let me suggest that there's substantial evidence in this record to show that there is a clear danger with regard to these medical marijuana facilities, and that those dangers have been manifest throughout the state and in the locations of where those facilities have been allowed. And what have your neighboring cities found in connection with their ordinances? I'll just pick a couple as an example. In Grover Beach, in their ordinance at page 170, they say, whereas the cities of Arcata, Roseville, Oakland, Hayward, Fairfax, and Berkeley all have operating medical marijuana dispensaries and all have experienced problems with the operation of these dispensaries. They have all experienced an increase in criminal activity around the dispensaries, including the illegal sale of controlled substances, smoking of marijuana in public, and the criminal element being drawn to the dispensary location. Some have had robberies and other serious crimes being committed in and around the locations of the dispensaries. Paso Robles, page 174 of the staff report, the fourth whereas clause. Whereas there are known to be increased incidences of crime-related secondary impacts associated with the locations of medical marijuana dispensaries, which is contrary to policies that are intended to promote and maintain the public health, safety, and welfare. Pismo Beach, page 180. Third whereas clause. Whereas the City Council is aware that medical marijuana dispensaries have been established in several locations in California, and as a consequence, some local agencies have reported increases in illegal drug activity, illegal drug sales, robbery of persons leaving dispensaries, loitering around dispensaries, falsely obtaining identification cards to qualify for medical marijuana, and other increases in criminal activity. The last one I'm going to mention is Royal Grande. Identification cards to qualify for medical marijuana, trespass, display and discharge of firearms, vagrancy, on-site consumption of marijuana and marijuana-enhanced products, driving under the influence of marijuana, excessive traffic disturbance calls, and vehicular violations. There is significant, substantial evidence in the record before you with regard to the negative secondary effects, so I think I've adequately covered that point. With respect to the comment by the speaker about that there have been no city council members that have been arrested for allowing medical marijuana dispensaries in their cities, he is correct, and I think I said that when I was commenting on it. I merely pointed out that it's a risk, but it hasn't happened yet. Mr. Colomarino had a question about the City of Los Angeles case. I'm very familiar with that case. I've been following that. In the City of Los Angeles, that was heard by Judge Chalfant. In downtown Los Angeles Superior Court. The reason he found that the City of Los Angeles moratorium was not effective was because the City of Los Angeles moratorium was only valid for up to 24 months, and that 24-month period had elapsed. It was a zoning ordinance. My understanding was that the city had taken the position that it was a moratorium related to public safety and therefore did not have the 24-month limitation. 24-month limitation, whereas here we're not dealing with that issue. You're not up to your 24 months yet. You're only what's being presented to you today is to extend the current moratorium for a period of 10.5 months. So I believe I've covered their comments. If I haven't, I can respond to further questions.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Did you have another question? That was it?
That answered my questions. Thank you.
Councilmember Clay.
The Morro Bay case, Brian, did you have any information on that? I know the proprietor was convicted and he was here at one time.
I'm familiar with that case also. Yes, there was a prosecution in federal court of the operator of a medical marijuana facility in Morro Bay. He was convicted and he did receive a sentence.
Thank you.
Do we all want to just speak to it and then we'll make a motion, or how do you want to? Because I should be the last one. If nobody else wants to speak, I can go. Do you want to? Okay. So I'll go ahead and just give my feedback. I really appreciate the people who came out tonight and gave their testimony. It's not an easy thing to do, and I'm very concerned that our state does not have the funding to get after this fraud where people who don't need it get approval to get medical marijuana. And that's where we end up with this crime element. So that bothers me that there is not that structure in place that the state can uphold to make sure that the dispensing of medical marijuana is done in a safe way for the city that has the dispensary and also for the patients who receive it. I'm very glad that the people who came tonight haven't had problems, but what we've seen in the reports is overwhelming to the contrary, and I don't think we need to bring that to a Tascadero. So even though I believe in medical marijuana, unfortunately I think things have to happen on the federal level to make this really happen here in our state. I believe I voted for it when it came, all those propositions. We have a gazillion of them at every November. I certainly supported the concept, but as the law is written, it's really insufficient to make it a smooth process, and so that's what I'm concerned about. So I'm going to support the city attorney's recommendation tonight. So, Councilmember Clay?
Yes, you know, I have similar feelings. But at the same time, I think it's important that we have this ban at this time. And I wish that medical marijuana was handled like any other prescription drug through a pharmacy. And, you know, the state, the federal government needs to get their act together so we don't keep having these kind of conflicts. But the dispensary idea, compassionate whatever isn't working, in my opinion, and so I'm going to support both one and two here of this of Brian's suggestions.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Thank you, and I did want to thank all of the speakers that came out tonight. I, like Ellen, have spent most of my life in the health and human services area. I was, in fact, the county drug program administrator for a number of years prior before the countywide mental health administrator. So I've worked in the area where there's a need and also the abuse. I certainly support medical marijuana and its use. I think some folks have found that useful. I'm concerned about
recognize that need by making an attempt to make this available. But the law is ambiguous and has some problems with law enforcement, as you have heard. The other cities in our county have chosen to ban it. And I have to ask, why does Atascadero have to be the city that accepts it? That if there are more suitable cities in our county, actually, for this dispensing of it, San Luis Obispo is our county seat, would be a much more suitable area. If it's going to be in the North County, Paso Robles is a larger city. Why isn't it going there? These cities have chosen to outlaw it or ban it. I don't know whether most people know, but there are no taxes derived to help fight the crime that goes along with it, as we have stated from our city attorney. There is no sales tax because it is considered a drug, just like any drug that is dispensed through a pharmacy, but yet it is not dispensed safely through the pharmacy. So when it goes into a city like Atascadero, a very small city, that drug enforcement problem or those associated crimes that may or may not come with that type of a dispensary fall on the dime of the city. Our police department would have to step forward and put extra time and extra men and or women on this problem. We just don't have that money, no resources for that right now. I think it's more appropriate that it be handled by a larger entity such as the County of San Luis Obispo or the State of California. So I, too, would enforce this. Thank you.
Councilmember O'Malley, you may go.
Sure. I'll go ahead and move we adopt staff's recommendation of the one, adopt an interim urgency ordinance extending the 45-day moratorium on the establishment and operation of medical marijuana facilities for a period of 10 months and 15 days through September 8, 2010, and two, refer to the Planning Commission for consideration of a draft ordinance to repeal existing ordinances regarding medical marijuana and adopt an ordinance prohibiting the establishment and operation of medical marijuana facilities in the city.
I'll second it.
Motion by Councilmember O'Malley, seconded by Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie. Roll call, please.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Yes.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie.
Yes.
Mayor Bayrou.
Yes.
4-0, motion passes.
And does anybody need to take a break? Okay, we'll take a physical needs break. Short, please. Okay, welcome back.
Facilities district is to offset the cost of just the residential portion of the project, not the commercial portions, for their impacts on police and fire services. This is a council policy that's been in effect for about 7 years now, where the city requires that residential projects be basically revenue neutral. So the only way they can get there is to form this special assessment district to offset some of their costs. The map on the screen behind me is the map that shows the area that will be included in the assessment district area. Under state law, Proposition 218, we actually have to go through a formal balloting process where the property owners, which is just the developer at this point, must vote to actually allow this special tax to be created on the property. In the future, this tax will end up on the 32 lots that are there, and it basically will result in about a $45 per month tax that will be used to fund new police and fire personnel services for the benefit of this development and other new developments that are also part of the facility district program. I believe this will be about the 9th residential subdivision to annex into the facility district. So that'll conclude my overview. I'm going to turn it over to the city clerk. She has a process that we have to go through in order to verify the election.
Now I say my part.
I was just going to say, did you want me to kind of explain?
Yeah, if I'm going to have the city clerk explain to the public the process, there is certain language we need to use, so she's going to explain it.
Thank you. The city contracted with Wildan Financial Services to assist us in the formation of this community facilities district. There are specific requirements on the procedure that is to be followed to accomplish this, and we will be following that procedure tonight. Wildan Services has provided a script, actually, for myself and the mayor to follow, and that will help guide us through that process. So in the beginning, Mayor Brewer, you would start.
This is the time and place for the public hearing for the proposed annexation of the territory to the City of Atascadero Community Facilities District number 2005-1. And then, has notice of this hearing been given in accordance with the Mello-Roos Community Facilities Act of 1982?
Notice of the public hearing was published at least 7 days prior to conducting tonight's public hearing as required by the Mello-Roos Community Facilities Act of
1982. Majority protest exists.
No written protests have been received from the landowner within the annexation area. There is only one landowner. Therefore, a majority protest does not exist.
It is now time to take testimony from the public. So this is time we will take any public comment. Seeing no one approach the podium, we will close public comment. Is there anyone wishing to speak in regards to the annexation of territory to CFD number 2005-1 and related matters? No. Public hearing is now closed, and this requires a motion.
We will need a motion and a second to close the public hearing.
I move that we close the public hearing.
Second.
Motion by Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie, seconded by Councilmember Clay.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember O'Malley?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor Bayrou?
Yes.
4-0, motion passes.
Have 100% of the consent and waivers been received by the city clerk so that we may hold the special election today?
Yes.
Does the city clerk concur with holding the special election today?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Has the city clerk received the ballots from the landowners in the annexation area?
Yes, I have.
Are there any further ballots to be submitted to the city clerk?
No.
So we will, could the city clerk proceed to canvass the ballots?
Yes, and I would ask that you take like a 2-minute recess while I open the ballot and figure it, and then we can resume.
We will take a short break. I ask that we all remain seated so we don't prolong the process. So we will just pause briefly. Are we ready? Okay, so our pause is over, and the city clerk may begin.
I, the city clerk for the City of Atascadero Community Facilities District Number 2005-1, Public Services Special Election, have completed the canvas of ballots, and it is as follows. And actually, if you want to look at page 277 of your agenda packet, that is the Exhibit A to the resolution that you'll be voting on in a few moments here, and that exhibit shows there's blanks for the votes.
Okay.
And there was one ballot, it was one owner, and they did vote yes on both Proposition A and Proposition B. So it's one vote for yes, zero for no on each of those propositions.
Okay. Second.
Motion by Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie and seconded by Councilmember Clay. And let me just pause real quick. Do I need to have a separate public hearing because this is now an action of the council? Or not public hearing, but a public comment period, or not? I just want to make sure I'm not cutting anybody off.
You could.
I could? Okay. Okay.
You did already you opened it up to the public, but you're welcome to do that again.
Okay. So I'll go ahead. Is anyone interested in making a comment on this process? Seeing none, there will be no further public comment on this. We'll move forward with a roll call on the motion. Thank you.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes.
Councilmember O'Malley?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor Bayrou?
Yes.
4-0, motion passes. Thank you.
So that concludes item B2. We now move to item B3, which is Title IX Planning and Zoning Text Amendment, 2009-1335. And Mr. Frace, our Community Development Director, will be giving the report. Is there any ex parte communication from the council? Seeing none, we'll begin.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. This item before us tonight is a series of fairly minor code text changes that are being recommended by the City Planning Commission for approval tonight. Just in terms of background, we periodically look at Title IX, which is our zoning ordinance, and make sure it's up to date and come through with cleanups and amendments as needed. These are basically minor clarifications that need to be made, and also some consistencies for some recent policies that we're looking to clarify as well. So the purpose of these amendments tonight are, one, to help streamline the permit process a little bit further, and to aid some dormant projects that are in risk of being expired due to time limitations. There's also a couple provisions here that would be consistent with some of the recommendations that we've gotten from ADE, which prepared our economic strategy. And then there's some fixes of some inconsistencies in the zoning ordinance. So there are six changes that are before the council tonight. The first would be to combine the time limits for conditional use permits with tentative maps on master plan of development projects. That will simplify the process not only for the applicants but for the city staff as well. We're also looking, number two, to expand our definition of auto dealers to include recreational vehicles and smaller boats. That's been an issue that's been brought up by some auto dealers and some of the there's also a recommendation to expand and clarify some of the uses in the commercial professional zone, and then to update the swimming pool fence requirements to be consistent with the state building code. So the first item is the conditional use permit modification. What we're recommending there is that, well, typically conditional use permits expire within 1 year of approval. Tentative maps typically expire within 2 years of approval. A lot of our master plan projects that have planned developments have both a CUP and a map on there. That means that the CUP will expire in 1 year, the map in 2 years, so we get into a cycle where the applicant has to apply for time extensions every other year. It's very confusing and it's very time consuming. What we're recommending is that we only use the tentative map time limits when we have both a tentative map and a CUP. The tentative map time limits are longer They're better described in state law in terms of how they're to be extended, and we think that will be a more simpler process if we just use the tentative map as the date for expiration on these master plans. So CUPs will still have expirations when they stand alone, but when they're combined with a map, then the map will be the dictating time limit. So the proposed text change is included in your staff report. Just show it up here on the screen really quickly for you. The second is an update to the definition of auto dealers. What we've heard from the business community is that this definition is overly restrictive because it did not include small boats and recreational vehicles. The Planning Commission is recommending that we add those definitions. So light trucks are clarified to include classes 1, 2, and 3, which are smaller commercial or smaller passenger vehicle size trucks. We also are including federal boats classified as Class A and Class 1, which are under 26 feet in length, and then we're adding the recreational vehicle and recreational utility definitions to the auto dealer definition. Sales lot, which used to include recreational vehicles and trailers, will still include the larger boats and the larger trucks, but the recreational vehicles will move up and into the auto dealer definition. The third change that's being recommended, the fourth change did deal with the idea of clarifying the personal services to include day spas and licensed therapeutic massage. As I mentioned, we've discovered there's a number of problems with that definition that we're waiting on some state legislation to help clarify. We have a section in our adult ordinance that deals with massage parlors, and we just need some time to get all those changes straightened out. So we're recommending no action on that. So when you make your motion tonight, we are recommending that we take no action on item number 4. Number 5 has to do with some changes to the CP zone. That is the commercial professional zone. Primarily, that zone's along Morro Road. It came to staff's attention that we had the potentially allowable use or conditionally allowable use listed as sexually oriented businesses, but in our adult ordinance code, it's clear that that use is not to be allowed in the CP zone. So we want to clarify or correct the CP zone so it is consistent with our adult ordinance. At the same time, the ADE study has recommended additional tourist uses and designations along Morro Road. So we are recommending that we add the definition hotels and motels to the CP zone. That would then allow smaller hotels and motels to be built along Morro Road in the office zones. That seems like an appropriate and consistent use with that district. This would be the proposed code text change. Then the final one is there was an old provision in the zoning ordinance dealing with swimming pool fences. Since that was adopted many years ago, the state's adopted a number of regulations in the building code dealing with swimming pool fences. So our standards are redundant and inconsistent. So we're just recommending that we change it to say that the fencing will be consistent with the building code. I think that will be an easy clarification. So this is exempt from any environmental determination. There's a couple findings that need to be made for a zoning change. Those are included in your staff report and resolutions. The recommendations are from the Planning Commission. They are recommending we adopt the 6 proposed changes. As I mentioned, staff is recommending that we drop the change right now for the day spas and licensed therapeutic massage. Your alternatives are listed in your staff report. And that will conclude my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Thank you. I wanted to make sure I understood a comment I thought I heard towards the beginning. On Morro Road, for example, where you are adding hotels and motels as a possible conditional use and eliminating the sexually oriented businesses.
That's correct.
And when you reference hotels, motels, I assume inns, it's anything that pays transient occupancy tax over, is it 5 beds, or there's some range of residences?
It's There isn't a size limitation, but it is temporary lodging in the commercial zone of less than 30 days. If it's over 30 days, then it would be an apartment.
Okay, so that's really the primary distinction, is it's less than 30 days and the requirement to pay transient occupancy tax, and you're, in our definition, you're a hotel or a motel.
Correct.
Thank you.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes, Warren, my question is just on the gas pump procedure that you recommended. So are you saying that convenience stores, you know, like 7-Elevens and stuff, are they different now, or can we still have those type of stores with the gas pumps?
They could, but they would be treated as a service station and be subject to the conditional use permits. And most of them are now the larger convenience stores that have 4 to 8 pumps and the full convenience store, and that's typically what we see today, and those are already required to have use permits. This provision was for a small store with 2 pumps or less. From what we hear, there is no economic viability to a station with that few of pumps, so I think it's not something that's likely to happen anyways.
So do we have any in Atascadero with 2 pumps? I'm trying to think.
I believe there's probably a couple. I think Stagecoach Liquor up on El Camino Real may only have 2 pumps.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie.
Yeah, I have a question regarding recreational vehicles, that you had a size limitation for light trucks and also for boats, but was there expected to be a size limitation on recreational vehicles?
No.
So those could be as large as a school bus or beyond and still be sold on a car lot, let's say?
Yes.
Is there a rationale behind that particular thought?
Well, typically recreational vehicles tend to be fairly large to begin with. What we heard from the business community is they would like as much flexibility as possible. It doesn't seem very clear under the state law that... Bed and breakfast, by definition, only exists in the residential zone. So once it's in a commercial zone, it's a hotel or a motel. It may look exactly the same as what you would call a bed and breakfast, but by definition, that just bed and breakfast is a hotel in a residential zone, and it's not a bed and breakfast if it's in a commercial zone.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. I don't see any more lights, so I guess that ends our questions. Anyone want to speak from the public? I'll open the public comment. Seeing no one approach the podium, we'll go ahead and close public comment and bring it back to the council for discussion or a motion.
I move approval of staff's recommendations as modified.
Second. Go ahead.
Motion by Councilmember O'Malley, seconded by Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie. Roll call, please.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Yes.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie.
Yes.
Mayor Bayrou.
Yes.
4-0, motion passes.
That ends our public hearings for tonight, and we move on to management reports. Item number one is a resolution approving the form of and authorizing the execution and delivery of a purchase and sale agreement and related documents with respect to the sale of the seller's Proposition 1A receivable from the state, and directing and authorizing certain other actions in connection therewith. How's that for a title? And I believe Ms. Jerry Rangel is here to give us the report. Thank you.
Thank you. I know that's a mouthful. Thank you very much, Mayor and Council. Essentially, the Prop 1A securitization program revolves around the state's borrowing of about approximately $663,000 of property tax under the Prop 1A suspension provisions. The city has an option to participate at no risk, cost, or obligation, or as an alternative, can borrow from the wastewater fund. And as you said, the recommendation's quite lengthy, but essentially the staff is recommending participating in the program. The securitization program will provide funding concurrent with the state borrowing, so it should be ideally a very seamless process cash flow wise. The Prop 1A securitization, or Prop 1A, if you just as a little refresher, it was overwhelmingly passed by voter period, and they must be repaid again before it can be borrowed a second time. Given that the state has exercised the provisions under the securitization or under the suspension program, the city has two choices to respond in response to this. The city can participate in the securitization program, or we can borrow from the wastewater funds. Those would be the unprogrammed wastewater funds. Under the Prop 1A securitization program, the city essentially sells its receivable for cash. The city gets 100% of the amount that the state borrows, and it's through the California Communities, which is the California Statewide Communities Development Authority. They issue the bonds and they do all of the work for the city, fortunately, so it's not such a burden internally. And then the documents must be received by the city by, or from the city by the 6th in order to participate. The benefits are of participation are many. The payments from the program are timed concurrent with the state's borrowings. So we will receive an inflow of cash when the state borrows on January 15, 2010 and May 3, 2010. So the cash balances will not be affected by the state's borrowing. And because the state's receivable is irrevocably sold, there's essentially no ongoing ties between the city and the state's obligation. That means that the city will not suffer any risk or hardship if the state defaults, which, you know, I can't tell you if that's going to happen, but it's better for us to kind of get out of the mix. This also relieves the city of any obligation or recourse to bondholders. There are no opportunity costs from a reduction in fund balance or cash flow because both of these are unaffected if we participate in the program. General fund balances can be invested with the remainder of the city's portfolio, and the city is able to earn a return equal to that of what we would typically earn on the regular portfolio. The state has announced its rate at 2%. So if we did not participate in the program, we'd be earning an interest rate at 2%. If we did participate, we'd be flowing with the rest of the city's portfolio, which can't really give you a number what that will be over the next 3 years. But last fiscal year, it ranged from 3.35% to 1.91%. So there's a significant opportunity that we may be able to fund balance. And the maximum return, as I said, is 2%. Any gain that the general fund might get off of that 2% is offset by the loan that they're paying in the interest that goes to the wastewater fund. If the state does default, which is a possibility, I suppose, there are potentially costs that could come up to force compliance to get the state to pay. And, of course, the general fund will be obligated to repay the wastewater funds. The program will provide identical replacement for the funds that the state has borrowed. And, essentially, $663,000. There's no risk, no cost, no obligations, no disruption in cash flow. City can reinvest at its own policies, by its own policies and its own rate. There's no restriction on the use of funds. It can be used for any legal purpose, is similar to what the property taxes would be used for, and the state will pay only 2%, and we may get that up to 3 years later. So we're losing the compounding factor as well, too. So with that, that concludes my presentation. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rangel. I know the Board of Supervisors did the same thing today. I was listening to their thing, and one of the supervisors, I don't remember which one, said, well, why don't they just go out and get their own money? Why do they have to go through us? And, you know, who knows? I can't figure that one out. I think you have to be a pretty good accountant or something. But I know that they approved this process as well. I don't see any lights on for questions, so thank you for your report. And I'll go ahead and open it up to public comment.
Good evening, Madam Mayor and council members. My name is David Benson. I live in 3F Meadows. I have the staff report in the full 30-some-odd pages that was on your website. And I have a few questions that I would like to ask about this transaction. This transaction is just talks about the $663,000 that is involved with Atascadero. There's 482 cities in the state of California that are affected by this legislation. And so I'd like to know what the total bond sale is. It's got to be over $1 billion. And I'd like to know how much money, based on his experience here, he's been serving in the city for a number of years. So could he beat that 2%? The other question is the 2% for 3 years, or is it 2% per year for 3 years? Well, it's in the report, it indicates it's 2% to be paid in 3 years. So I think there's a number of issues there. It says in the staff report here, there is no risk, no cost to the city. But it doesn't tell me that you have a legal opinion that says that. I don't know whether this is staff's opinion or whether it's a legal opinion from Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. And if it is from that firm, they only represent the California Statewide Communities Development Authority. They aren't going to defend you. Does our attorney have any questions about this transaction? And have they been raised and answered? You have in your report all transaction costs of the bond issuance and related bond interest will be paid by the state. The state's not going to pay that. The only thing the state's going to pay is 2% interest and whatever they borrow. That's what goes to that other agency. They aren't going to pay anything else. They don't have an obligation to pay anything else. So the state isn't going to pay the cost of bond issuance and that. What's going to happen? Oh, also there's underwriter's fees in here that you have an underwriter. And those, believe me, with a $1 billion bond issue, you got a lot of costs that you don't know anything about yet. So to get back to my point.
Can you please summarize?
Yes. What firm or legal firm is giving this opinion that the obligations on the bonds with regards to payment, reporting, disclosure, or other compliance and no credit exposure to the state? Who's making that opinion? And then bondholders will have no recourse if the state does not make the Proposition 1A repayment. Who made this opinion? You don't have enough information to decide.
Welcome.
Hello, I'm Lynn Colomarino, Atascadero resident. And I just want to pick up on some of the comments that Mr. Benz was making. He went through a lot of the costs associated with a bond issue of this nature. And from this pot, and it's willing to pay the costs associated with indemnifying the municipalities that it was taking the money from. So I can understand the basis for this transaction, and I can see that the state had a motivation to absorb these costs to satisfy the municipalities that it was taking the money from. But obviously it's something that the city attorney should be satisfied with, and so I think it would be useful to hear from him on this point. Thank you.
Welcome.
Madam Mayor, Council members, my name is Sandy Jack, Atascadero resident. I only have one question, and the presentation indicated that the state had to repay the money within the first borrowing before it could execute the second borrowing. What is the time frame between those two things? Can they happen simultaneously? So we're looking at a 6-year period versus a 3-year period. That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no one else approach the podium, we'll bring it back to staff to address some of those questions. I don't know if Mrs. Rangel or Wade or city attorney. I'll let you guys work on that.
The council, as Mr. Benz pointed out, is Orrick Carrington. I'm looking at the website for the California communities, statewide communities. The governor did sign into legislation the SB 67 establishing this program. So the program of the borrowing is different than the 2%. They are covering those costs with reference to the bond. It's an entirely different program if you elect to not be in the program into the statewide communities. Then you're on your own, and the rate is 2%. They're not just offering a 2% rate, and these communities are getting together to prepare a program. It says, as of October 20th, 2009, approximately 1,325 agencies have enrolled in the program. That number is comprised of 57 counties. Really what it says on the website. The key points of the legislation that the governor signed are the purchase price paid to local government agencies will be 100% of the amount of the property tax reduction. There will be no costs of issuance to participating local agencies. The only costs will be internal personnel time, and for the agencies that contract for attorney services, there would be local agency counsel costs. All interest and bond issuance costs will be paid by the state. Participating agencies have no obligation on the bonds and no credit exposure to the state. Each interested agency may enroll now to receive the required legal documents. Enrollment does not commit the local agency to the program, although you have to be, now our dates are getting late because we just had a storm, so you don't have another meeting before the enrollment period. All executed documents must be returned to the California Community Bond Council on or prior to November 6, 2009, subject to the enactment. Well, it's been enacted now, the legislation, so that one is different. It says, in terms of dates, the bond pricing is expected to be November 10, 2009, closing November 19th. 2009, distribution of proceeds to local agencies would then be in January and May. As I mentioned, the counsel for the project is Ora Carrington Sutcliffe of San Francisco. Is there more questions I could try to?
Sounds like it's covered to me. Is there any further questions from council? Go ahead.
Yes, Mayor, a couple of questions that were raised by Mr. Benz. There was a question regarding whether this would be a 2% interest rate per year or this would be 2% over 3 years.
Sorry? Jerry's indicating she hasn't seen a specification. I was trying to turn to something. That specifies the answer to your question there. Percent.
Right, and so, if I remember what Jerry said, it was a range of 1.9 up to about 3.5, so we're a little lower than 2, but not.
But you eliminate your risk costs.
Yes, I understand.
Of having to chase the state.
Okay, and I guess the big question for me would be, is there any recourse to the city should these bonds not perform? Those that buy these bonds expecting a certain amount of cash back at the end, if they don't perform, is the city on the hook in any way?
No, under the SB 67, the state took that responsibility.
Thank you.
Okay. Motion, anyone?
Well, Sandy had a question about
timing.
Go ahead.
Who had a question?
Sandy Jack had a question about the 10-year period, and you can apply twice. They could take our money twice and so on.
they can't borrow a second time without paying back the first time. And could that be occur simultaneously? So they say, thank you for loaning us money for two or three years. Here it's back. And by the way, we're borrowing it right away again.
Yes.
Would be one problem.
They could do that. Sure. That,
they couldn't borrow it twice at the same time. They have to pay it back before they could borrow it. They can borrow it twice in a 10-year period. So they could pay it back to you and take it again. But they have to pay it back to you with the interest, take it again, pay it back with interest, and then they couldn't do it for 4 years.
You have another question? Go ahead.
So in other words, if we were to go into this program, the state would consider the money paid back, correct? So next year they could come back and borrow again?
No. It's over the three-year period because we still have the, you know, they're using us as a finance vehicle in this case. But no, it's at the end of the 3 year.
Thank you.
When they actually perform.
Any further discussion? I'll accept a motion.
I'll move staff's recommendation. Well, you had the best question, like how come the state is taking our money to fix their problem? But setting that aside, I will move staff's recommendation.
And I will second it.
Okay. Motion by Councilmember O'Malley, seconded by Councilmember Clay. Roll call, please.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Yes.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie.
Yes.
Mayor Barrow.
Yes.
4-0, motion passes.
Great. That was managed water in styrofoam containers. And as many of you know, I am the Tuscadero representative for the Integrated Waste Management Authority for the County of San Luis Obispo, and we have been recognized as a county for our efforts at recycling and reducing waste in our county. City of Morro Bay, maybe a year and a half ago, adopted a very similar resolution, which is attached. It's just for to look at, not for approval tonight. And in an attempt to decrease the amount of waste going to our landfills. Plastic bottles, even though they are recyclable, are often like 90% of the time not recycled, and that is an issue across the country. I did ask the IWMA to report back other cities that have similar ordinances, and the ones that just banned the purchase of water bottles for their offices are Seattle, Santa Barbara, Albuquerque, Ann Arbor, San Francisco, and as we know, Morro Bay. My proposal is a resolution, not a ban. I'm not expecting everyone to suddenly stop using plastic water bottles and styrofoam containers, but it is to recognize that these are significant contributors to waste and landfill space in our across the country, and that we, as a city, can be leaders in the county and the state to do so. I've been pondering bringing this to the council for many months, and as we went through our fiscal constraints and adopted for financial reasons to no longer use plastic bottles in our facilities, I realized that it wouldn't be a huge change for the city function to no longer use plastic bottles. Another reason I brought this up at this time is because we recently had Coastal Cleanup Day and Creek Cleanup Day, where a significant amount of trash is picked up. And 60 to 80% of trash that is picked up on the beaches comes from inland sources, like cities like us, who have rivers and creeks that transport waste from the inland areas to the coastal areas. The last Coastal Cleanup Day, which my daughter participated in with her Earth Club at the high school, they picked up over 1 million pounds, not just in San Luis Obispo County, but in the state of California, over 1 million pounds of refuse. But for you all to review, and I'd like to hear some council discussion on if there's any support for this resolution.
Yeah. Well,
Councilmember Clay.
I'll just be nice and say that I can't support this at all, and I don't think we need to get into restricting water bottles. I would question your 90% figure, and you know, I understand that you're an environmentalist and you push these issues, but I think we got bigger bigger fish to catch than to do this. And I'm just not for it. We had the Revenor just got up and said that during colony days they passed out 2,000 water bottles to people to help out. And it's illegal. The bottles are legal. Styrofoam's legal. I'm not for this at all. So that's where I stand.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie.
Although I am not convinced that I would vote in favor of it, I think it's important for council members to have an opportunity to place items on the agenda. And as a courtesy to Ellen, I would be able to support that, and with the condition that it would not take a great deal of staff time or effort to go forward with this particular proposal. So I guess what I'm asking is it's going to take a lot of time for staff to do.
Mr. Bikini, would you like to respond to that?
You're in a bad position asking that question.
This is a pretty informal time. Would you like to respond to how you feel about that?
I'm not sure how much time it will take. We haven't looked into it at all. This was a measure to put it on the agenda.
What I provided for you, just Roberta, so you're aware, is pretty much it would be this kind of resolution, and then there's a brief staff report that's already been printed up and researched by the IWMA that looked at a lot of different references that will be part of the staff report, so you can verify them. And some of the facts that I presented tonight, Mr. Clay, were from references, not just my own knowledge. So I believe it wouldn't take a lot of
time. I did see that in there, and I appreciate that. I just, philosophically, I'm not sure that I will be able to go there with you. I consider water particularly to be something that needs to be available to the public. Mm-hmm. I don't like drinking out of public faucets. I think they're unhealthy. And water, unlike some of the substances that we've considered tonight, is both legal and healthful. So,
Your concern areas is one, staff time, and I want to speak a little bit about stewardship of the environment, and I also want to talk a little bit about the economic impact and suggest some alternatives for us to consider. Staff time, we may be able to address that. I have talked with the city attorney, and that there is precedent. I understand that we could simply direct the mayor to develop this item and bring it back and not utilize any staff time, is I think there is an example, and we just simply enter into some discussion. That's something that could be considered. However, I think, as you had said, Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie, that it would be a very tough thing for me to consider asking our business community to have any more restrictions imposed on them, and also looking at our economic impact on residents. And what I would consider is, though it's a feel-good resolution and to give some thought, I think there's some better ways we could do some good. And I think I look specifically at the recent changes in state law regarding gray water systems. For very little effort, we as a city could help assist local residents in adopting this new, easier to install systems that has immediate benefit for our residents, especially in drought times. That would be a good use of staff time and may have a better impact on the environment. Second, we're working on solar systems available for our community, and again, that's a high economic impact of a benefit for our community, and I think that's a better use of our time and staff's time. Third area to consider is looking at the low impact designs for stormwater systems. Again, I want to talk a little bit later under another report on that, but these are some things we could do that are very good stewardship items for the environment and would be a better, bigger bang for your buck in terms of what it does for our economic support of our community and having a good stewardship of our environment. And I would just end on our top priority as a council has been to work on economic development, and having been chair of the Air Pollution Control District Board, having sit on, you know, governor's appointment on a 5-county regional water quality control board, what I see is the best thing we could do for our environment is to improve the job, housing, shopping imbalance. Our number one priority for staff is economic development. It's
clear to the public that I was not proposing the ban of use of bottled water or styrofoam in our community. I was not imposing anything on the business community to incur more cost. I was trying to have our city show leadership by restricting itself from using these two items to provide leadership for others and to provide educational materials for others who are interested in following suit. We will move to committee reports. And I was unable to attend the Homeless Services Governing Board. The meeting happened to be the same week that the court monitors were at the state hospital, so I was unable to attend. And I don't know if staff was able to make it. No, not they weren't. It was the first meeting since it was officially sanctioned by the Board of Supervisors, so I apologize for not attending that. Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie, do you have any reports?
No reports.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes. I just have a statement to make, if you don't mind. I messed up on the other thing. But, you know, I would just like to, again, encourage people that work out of town, that shop out of town, that go to movies out of town, to get in your car and come back, and if you're going to eat at a restaurant, please eat at our restaurants. They're having a heck of a time staying in business, so you're going to have to get in that car anyway, and it's only like 10 minutes, so we have some. Don't tell me we don't have good restaurants. I mean, if I would weigh 300 pounds if I ate in all the good restaurants we have in Atascadero, so please, you know, shop in Paso, movies in Paso, work in San Luis, eat in Atascadero. Thank you.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Thank you. And what's your favorite restaurant in town, Jerry?
Deddy's. They're gone.
Well, we'll get them back. First item, Economic Vitality Corporation. We heard a good report from them this evening, and they will have their board meeting tomorrow in San Luis, 4 o'clock. And if there are any folks in the business community interested in that, I would be happy to have anyone join me as a guest to that once a month if someone would like. The League of California Cities, again, is a statewide effort to try to resist the state taking our money, as we've had to deal with tonight. And this Thursday evening at the Carlton Hotel, 5:30, you are all welcome to come to a presentation by Dave Mullinex. He's our regional representative of our three-county region, and we'll have some our transit center. And I could just ask staff, when will we hear back on the design possibilities for a is that a couple months away?
I'm not sure of the tentative schedule. I'll have to get that out to you.
Okay. I don't want to take the time this evening. I would like to have some opportunity to talk a little bit about the activities of the Regional Water Quality Control Board. It is a five-county region that our county is one of, and it's been a tremendous learning experience for me to be part of that. I think I came on when the big issue was stormwater programs statewide, and I think I could help bring on a city perspective, and we really dealt with a concern between the environmental community feeling we were not moving quick enough to implement federal law, and cities concerned about some of the language and what the impact was. And through that, there's been a compromise to, rather than trying to push through in about a year period with some misunderstandings and some problems related to definitions of terms, we're taking a two-year period as the regional board and really taking some leadership in and getting some grants that will assist with some specialists in low-impact design and giving some templates for cities to adopt, where we are really working as cities together in our region. And I think that's been very helpful, and I think many of the cities are buying into this approach where we're working together on solving some of these problems, and I think it's going well. The new challenge for us is what is referred to as irrigated agriculture. It is the topic that has been selected statewide for a lot of study. As you know, there's a major problems with farms up in our middle part of our state with some water issues and its impact on our economy. And it's going to be coming to our area soon, and it is a topic. And I hope that I could maybe take a little more time and maybe just agendize it to give maybe a little 10-minute discussion on that at a future time if accepted. Thank you.
As long as you say it with the farmers.
Okay. Any individual determination or reports from staff? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting. It's not even 9 o'clock.
Nope.